Welcome to the Golden Age of Cardboard podcast, where we remember a time when stacks of cards were held together with rubber bands and Mickey Mantles were put in bike spokes. We hope you will enjoy and reminisce as you come along with us as we tell stories about the baseball cards from the Golden Age of Baseball. We will examine the state of the vintage baseball card market and talk to some of the greatest collectors in the hobby. You won't be hearing us talk about any chrome or shiny cards here. Now, to take you on this retrospective journey, here's your host, direct from the shallow end of the gene pool, my son, Mike Moynihan.
Yo and hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Golden Age of Cardboard podcast. My name is Mike, and today I'm going to take you on to class a little bit. Honestly, I'm going to take you to school. I know this is a sports card podcast, and that's what we normally talk about on this show. But I think a lot of you guys that listen and watch to this show have an affinity and love for the history of the game, just as I do. In fact, that's what connects us to cards, is that we want a picture or statistics or whatever of a guy that we've heard about, that there's legend about, that maybe even we watched play a long time ago. And so there's this connection between history, both personal and baseball history, and sports cards. So today I have a really special guest, and I'm gonna give him a proper introduction, because I'm excited to have him on. And it's James Buckley Jr. He is an author, and he wrote a book called Baseball Hall of Fame, Celebrating the Game's Greatest Players. I'll show you guys the book real quick. We're going to talk about it a lot today, but there's the book. If you're watching, if you're listening, that's the name of it, the National Baseball Hall of Fame Collection. And Jim has written more than 150 books on sports for readers young and old, including biographies of sports heroes Roberto Clemente, Lou Gehrig, Babe Ruth, Jesse Owens, and Muhammad Ali. He is the author of the previous National Baseball Hall of Fame collection in America's Classic Ballparks. I have that book too, actually. I don't think Jim knows that, but I have that book. Among others, his first visit to the Hall of Fame was in 1989 when he attended the induction ceremony of Carl Yastrzemski, his boyhood hero. So let me bring him on now. Jim, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on today, Mike.
You know, I'm excited. I don't get to interview a lot of authors and talk to them. But I think...
Just regular people like you and me, Mike. So we put our baseball pants on one leg at a time.
We do. I think it's going to be fun, because I think we're going to find a lot of common interest, a lot of common background, common things that we care about.
Sure.
Tell everybody a little bit. I'd love to hear your story about your childhood, falling in love with baseball, whenever that happened, what that looked like, and then maybe how you transitioned that into becoming an author and writing books about the sport that you love.
Sure. Yeah. My first baseball game was Fenway Park, and I was 7 years old. And I was already a huge Sox fan because we lived in New Jersey at the time, but we spent all of our summers in Cape Cod. And your first game is your first love, and it just sticks with you forever. And became a huge fan early on, played the game when I was a kid. I had to quit when I was 9 because my Little League coach was a Nazi. No, not really, but he treated us like slaves, and we all left. And so I never played again, which is sort of weird. I've been involved in baseball since I was 9 years old, but I never played since then. All through high school, I was basically aiming to be a sports writer of some sort, liked writing, liked sports. Baseball was my first love. Moved to California, and the very first person I met when I was 13 years old, is still my best friend today, and he was also a Red Sox fan. So we had a bond instantly, and I had a co-conspirator in keeping the Red Sox as my team, even though I lived 3,000 miles from Fenway Park. So all through college, wrote about sports for various college and school places. After college, moved to New York with one goal, which was to get a job at Sports Illustrated, and after freelancing for 2 or 3 years in the city, including getting to interview Willie Randolph sitting in the dugout at Yankee Stadium. So that was pretty cool. Hard for a Red Sox fan, great for a baseball fan. I did work at Sports Illustrated. I was there for 4.5 years and had a great time, learned a lot. Moved back to California and for life, because New York was tough back then. And so I then went to the dark side. I worked for the National Football League for 7 years. I know it's a different ball, but it's still sports, and we had a great time with it. And then in 2000, I started a company that produces books, and that's what we do. We produce books mostly for kids, but also for adults in all sorts of areas, but sports is very much the core of what we do. And so I've written, as you said, a lot of sports books for kids, biographies, histories. This is the 6th or 7th book I've done with the Hall of Fame. We do an annual book for kids called The Scholastic Year in Sports, which is if your listeners have kids with a scholastic book fair in their school, I'm in it every day, and I really appreciate their support paying the mortgage, so please keep it up. And so basically, because of that book, I get to follow all sports all the time and get paid for it, which is a nice change because I would do that anyway, so it's nice to have a chance to get paid for it. And as I said, baseball has remained the core of my favorite sports to watch and love. And since 1995, I've helped run a summer wood bat baseball league here in Santa Barbara, where I live. And we're the Santa Barbara Foresters, and we've won 10 NBC World Series national championships since 2006. And 60 of our guys have gone on to play in the majors, which is so much fun for me as a grown-up to watch these, you know, guys I knew when they were 18, 19 years old. See their dreams come true. You know, the dream that obviously I never had come true, but having them, you know, make it really means a lot to me and to everybody who works with the team. So, so it's great. So I get to write about baseball and get paid for it. So everything's going great.
I think the green with envy would be description of a lot of our listeners and watchers who wouldn't want to love to have it, to love to be able to write about the sport that we love. And mm-hmm. That's pretty awesome that you've turned that into a career and really been very successful with it. The book is really great. I'll give you a quick review of your own material from my perspective.
Fingers crossed.
I'm not going to write it down. I'm just going to tell you to your face. And incredibly well done. I love how it's broken down by position. Actually, I think that's not unique, but it's definitely different than normal, right? It's not alphabetical. It's not something, right. But it's very logical for a baseball guy, right? By position. Right. I love how you have at least some profile on every player that's in the Hall of Fame. And then you do managers, mm-hmm. you do executives. Well, mm-hmm. most of them, right?
Most of them, yeah. It's about 85%.
It's pretty close.
Yeah.
And especially a lot of the Negro League guys that you
Absolutely.
Profile. And those are stories that I think most casual baseball fans certainly don't know. And even some diehard baseball fans don't know. And they're worth reading. You know, I kind of took it as I just did a position a night and I kind of went through each position over the last few days, mm-hmm. Reading the different things. The pictures are amazing. All the photographs. I love the memorabilia inclusions and kind of interweaving within the stories. I saw Lou Gehrig's my favorite guy of all time, and I saw the certificate he got when he made the 200 home run club. I thought that was right. a fascinating yeah. thing.
The best piece of Lou Gehrig memorabilia isn't in there. It's a contract. His actual baseball contract. Two editions ago of this book, we actually had a facsimile of his contract. And in the standard baseball contract of the 1920s, every player got two sets of uniforms, home and away. They had to put in a $100 deposit with the team and return the uniforms at the end of the season to get their deposit back.
Wow.
I mean, that's in me, like how things have changed, department. Can you know, today they get a brand new jersey 4 times a game if they want it. I just love that. That was so of its time when guys were working two jobs. You know, Gehrig worked in the offseason because he didn't make enough money full-time as a baseball player. Well, all of them did. Yeah. And to see that is in terms of seeing the history of the game versus today, that to me has always been one of those really kind of fascinating bits of trivia that tells a big story.
It's interesting that you say that. That inspires me because I have a Yankees contract from the 20s. It's a no-name player, but I've never read it.
The terms are fascinating. It is, and you see in those terms what the players went through in the 60s and 70s trying to break out of the reserve clause and how baseball controlled its players so heavily. And the seeds of it are right there in those contracts. And so when the guys in the 60s and 70s and Kurt Flood and Messerschmidt and all those guys were fighting to get, you know, be free agents and have what we have today, reading those things, it's a really interesting look at the business side of baseball.
Yeah, and it dates it even further back a little bit when Koufax and Drysdale teamed up to try to collectively bargain for their salaries, and that got, you know, kind of screwed up. They wanted to use agents. The owner wouldn't allow it.
It was a really different time. You know, Stan Musial wrote a letter saying, "Hey, I kind of deserve a raise," and the guy said, "Yeah, no." I mean, Stan Musial, right? I mean, the Ralph Kiner, the classic Ralph Kiner joke is after leading the league in homers for like the sixth time in a row, he goes to the Pirates general manager and says, "Hey, you know, I think it's kind of time I get a raise." And the guy said, "Well, you know, Ralph, we finished last. We'll see. We can finish last without you, and you'll take what you get." So, yeah, it was I love that. That's some great behind the scenes stuff that I really enjoy reading about.
So when you start writing the book and you start doing your research and who you're going to include, et cetera, what things you're going to say about them, do you go visit the Hall of Fame and coordinate with them, or do they kind of give you a lot of license to make the stories what you want them to be?
Right. Well, the Hall of Fame obviously has final approval of all this. It's a licensed product of the National Baseball Hall of Fame and Library. So they, you know, I know they're going to read it. So I'm not going to be out there trying to dig up dirt on any of these guys and put them in any sort of significantly bad light. Obviously, we're going to tell the truth. Pete Rose isn't in there. So we're going to be, it's all factually correct and true. And all of these players are only given a very small capsule summary. So this is really, I see this as kind of a starting point for people to explore further. So I wanted to sort of, with each guy, create some entry points of interest, some particular points of interest for their particular career and life, and inspire people to say, "Oh, that is, you know, that's fantastic." But I want to find out more. And obviously, they can go to Hall of Fame websites, which have even more extensive biographies of all these guys. And now, of course, I also suggest to your readers, if they're not aware of it, the Save Your Baseball History Project is fantastic. There are very, very long, super detailed biographies of hundreds and hundreds of major leaguers going back to the very early days of those times on the Save Your website. And those are some of the best, most in-depth, well-researched biographies out there in the baseball world. But back to your point, I wanted to be representative of all those. I'm a very big fan of pre-1900s baseball, so I love that the Hall has made a point of including some of the pioneers of the game, King Kelly and, you know, Cap Anson and people like that, you know, Hoss Radbourne and people like that who are great, you know, names in baseball past. Obviously, wanted to include, as you say, broke it up into positions, as does the Hall. The Hall pretty much specifically says, "You are this position," even though obviously more recently in more recent times players would be in a lot more different positions. The Hall kind of, like they pick a cap, they kind of pick a position. Yeah. And as you say, it's kind of a natural way to sort of organize the book. And with each of those position groups, I chose one representative sort of mega Hall of Famer for each position to have a longer biography to put a little more context to their career and how they fit into the history of that position. So Gehrig, of course, is the first baseman, and you know, we've got Ozzie Smith and Babe Ruth and Willie Mays and people like that who obviously get special treatment.
Mike Schmidt.
Schmidt for third, yeah, obviously the all-time third baseman. And that's how we put it all together. I write it myself, and then obviously I work with the Hall if they have any questions. They're also obviously a very useful fact checker, because obviously, like everyone, I'm not perfect. And so to have their even more in-depth expertise than mine go over everything was very helpful. All the photography does come from the Hall of Fame, well, for the most part from the Hall of Fame. They have obviously a huge collection of photography they've gathered over the last 100 plus years. A lot of it is, especially the older stuff, is really, again, evocative of its time. you know, in the 40s and 50s and even in the 60s, the press release photo, the teams were actually supplying a lot of the photos that fans would see. Not every newspaper covered every game and every spring training. So you get a lot of these classic posed photos. It's the kind of photos that became baseball cards. A lot of the sort of the classic poses of the bat on the shoulder and the pretending to throw and the you know, the tag at second where there's nobody sliding in it. All those kind of classic photos that they pose all those guys in the spring training all kind of evolved from the press release stuff that the teams would have. And a lot of that went to the Hall because it was owned by the teams. So they don't have necessarily the fantastic action pictures of every game because that's really a news function. And so it's again, great classic stuff. And for us historic history fans, you know, every page has something fun to look at.
Absolutely. I love that about it. We'll get back to the book in a second. I want to talk a little bit because in my viewership, readership, listenership, whatever you want to call it is, we're all sports card guys for the most part and gals. And so what history do you have with baseball cards when you were a kid? Did you ever collect? Was that ever a thing for you? As much as you love the game, it surprises me that you're not a collector.
Yeah, I did when I was a kid. I kind of got out of it after probably, you know, junior high, moving on to just other things in my life. But in my 20s and 30s, I wrote a lot for Topps Magazine, which was Topps had a magazine, national magazine on card collecting, really in the, when it was the big super mega bump, like 88, 89, 90, somewhere in there when baseball cards suddenly became a thing again. And Topps put out a magazine, and I got to write quite a number of articles for that. More about general baseball history, but we did do some card coverage as well. And then I'm trying to think of some other baseball card-related stuff. Well, I mentioned the only card I do have probably in my collection is an 1889 Old Judge cigarette card of Dick Buckley, who was the only major leaguer of my name to play more than a few games. So I was really happy to track that down at an auction a few years ago. That's my card collection. It's not extensive. I'm sorry. I'm just a typist.
It's interesting because I have this kind of internal question that I'm always stewing on, and it's kind of the chicken and the egg thing. And it's like, do you have to love baseball to love baseball cards, or can you love baseball cards without loving baseball as a sport? And I think it's impossible to imagine loving the cards without loving the sport. It seems so.
It seems kind of mercenary. Yeah, it seems kind of mercenary to just care about the cards as objects without understanding their meaning. And I mean, you probably are not a huge, you know, maybe you are, but maybe because you like all sports. But I'm guessing that the vast majority of people who are really great baseball card collectors don't spend a lot of time on hockey cards or, you know, football cards. You know, they might, but baseball is going to really be their first thing. So, I think it's more of a sport.
Yeah, I think the hobby is obviously incredibly diverse. There are guys that collect everything. Some guys only focus on a team, a player, an era. So it can range as much as people range, right? Everybody has their own thing. But by and large, baseball and especially my audience, the vintage era, I call it this is called Golden Age of Cardboard, the golden era of baseball in the 50s, 60s when New York teams dominated, but there were lots of great personalities and heroes that were created during that period. And I get a lot of people, in 20 years, nobody's going to know who Mickey Mantle was. And I just vehemently disagree with that. I think that we are entering an age where having a book on your, you know, coffee table or in your library of resources is becoming more and more scarce since everything can be found instantaneously if you want on the internet. And that, so it's a double-edged sword, right? It's awesome that information is readily available. It's also like, well, what happened to, I used to sit and just read the baseball encyclopedia, you know, just for giggles. That was like a fun Saturday night for me, which
sounds familiar.
It's a miracle that I'm married, but the truth is, that that's leaving, I think, a lot. It doesn't mean that these players won't be historically significant or relevant in the card industry. There's a misunderstanding of, as people age, they look backwards more. And kids, you're looking forward, right? Because most of your life is in front of you. As you age, somewhere along the way, that pendulum swings and you start looking backwards beyond your own life, typically. Like, you'll go, wow, right, what happened before me? What happened in my parents' time, my grandparents? I love hearing about Ty Cobb just as much as I love hearing about, you know, Ronald Acuna Jr. You know, mm-hmm. To me, both are great. And why right. can't, you know, so I want to learn about all of it, the whole spectrum, and your appetite for knowledge, I think, grows as you age as well. You just, it's like you want to learn even more. Like, what else don't I know? You know?
Right. Well, a lot of the work I've done over the last 20 years has been writing for young people, kids mostly. And I remember growing up, the way I learned about the game was to read about it from people who had been around, who were like me, old guys then. There were these great books by Xander Hollander in the 1960s and 70s, and you'd read stories of the 50s and 40s and 30s. I don't think you can really truly appreciate any sport, especially baseball perhaps, today without understanding the past. And so a lot of the work I've been trying to do, and this Hall of Fame is really kind of part of that, is to keep people going on the continuum of sports fans, right? We're always on a continuum of our fanhood and our interest. And I want to make sure that the kids today jump on and stay on. And like I said, I don't think you can really appreciate how great Shohei was. What's the one person they talk about with Shohei Ohtani? Babe Ruth, right? When they talk about Mike Trout, they're looking at, oh my God, who are the multi-talented, who Mickey Mantle comes up with Mike Trout. When they see Verlander go have a long career with a lot of success, well, God, remember Seaver, you know, and remember, you know, Drysdale you mentioned. One of my personal heroes, Christy Mathewson. I love telling people about Christy Mathewson. And when they hear about what they did, whether it's me telling them or writing about it in the book, when they hear about it, they're amazed. They're shocked and thrilled because that connects to the thing they're watching right now. And it immediately links to generations of baseball. Baseball doesn't have a clock. I mean, it has pitch clocks, but it don't count. It doesn't have a clock, and neither does the history of the game. It just always goes on, and every day adds something new to it. So the more you can understand where you've been, the better you're going to understand today, and the more you're going to appreciate tomorrow.
So what do you do to try to get it to stick with kids? What do you, are there certain stories, anecdotes that you think stick better with young people? How do we get to these kids? And to your point, which I think is incredibly valid, not only in just learning the game, but being in the hobby too. If they get in the hobby, how do we get them to stick in the hobby and not just be worried about the money or, you know, whatever else? Any advice there?
Sure. Humanize, personalize, connect the players of the past who have no voices in real life and they can't see them move in video for the most part. Their stories need to be as personal as they can and as make them as human as they can and as real to life and not unapproachable physical gods. Okay, so when you write about, Willie Mays is still with us, thank goodness, so we can see him in person and understand the joyous personality he had. But when you write about a Satchel Paige, okay, so to hear him talk through whatever you describe and to use his words to express what he was expressing and the joy and the fun and the excitement he brought to life, if you can get that across to somebody, they're going to remember that guy. They're going to remember when he played. They're going to remember why he had to not be in the majors until he was 48 years old or whatever. That is a real story, and it connects directly to things that are happening today in the world and how we are trying to be more inclusive all over the sports world, over the real world. The last 2 years, Major League Baseball has finally gotten to the point where Negro League statistics will be officially included in Major League Baseball statistics. They're already in baseballreference.com. So if you guys, obviously, I mean, you guys all know Baseball Reference, but they're already in there. But they will soon be part of official Major League stats as well. That's a huge leap. That's a universe of stories opening up because numbers tell stories. And so when you are able to go and see where Josh Gibson fit in, Oscar Charleston should be as famous as Babe Ruth in the baseball world. He was absolutely on par to him in terms of all-around skill, in terms of impact on his sport, in terms of impact on his league. He even was perhaps more so, you know, he was a leader, he was a manager for 9 years of championship teams. Absolutely mega superstar that 1.2% of baseball fans have ever heard of. That's the kind of thing I'm trying to correct, is to get those stories out there and to make baseball fans understand that the continuum doesn't, it breaks down if you don't have those stories as part of your love of the game. So kids, for kids, the more you can talk about them as human beings, going through real life struggles, going through real life deals, talk about, did they have kids? What were they like when they were kids? What was baseball like for Mickey Mantle growing up, for Carl Yastrzemski growing up on a potato farm in Long Island? You know, the things that the kids did back then, how Roberto Clemente was written about for kids, grew up in a way that he had to basically take socks and ball them up really tightly together and wrap them with string to have a baseball because his family was so poor and in Puerto Rico. They would, you know, carve sticks for bats. Kids, they can't imagine carving sticks. And if you tell them the story of it, they can, oh, wow, that, man, that's pretty intense. That makes them personalized. And so that's my answer is, and same with the card collecting. The piece of cardboard is the door. And you just got to open the door and go inside and you'll find whole lives behind every card.
Yeah, there's a treasure trove of information out there ready to be learned.
Absolutely.
We have to do our part to encourage that next generation to embrace it and to absorb it. Can you, Jim, in your book you do this, but I'd love to hear you talk about the history of the Hall of Fame itself and where it, you know, how did it evolve? How did it start? And maybe tell everybody some of that.
Well, as we all know, because we're actually intelligent, smart, and well-researched baseball fans, the Hall of Fame started as a lie because it was founded in Cooperstown, New York in 1936, which, of course, the Mills Commission in 1903 foolishly and wrongly chose Abner Doubleday and the myth of him inventing the game in 1839 in Cooperstown, New York. So Cooperstown as a town ran with that massively, and it became a tourist destination. And the city fathers and the Clark family especially said, this is a great story. We can help our beloved town, and we can honor baseball, and let's build a Hall of Fame. And it began as essentially a collection of kind of displays in the town hall. And some people started asking old time baseball players, can you contribute something to this library we're building of baseball memorabilia and history? And then a sports writer named Ford Frick, who later became the commissioner, said, well, let's you know, make it more official. And a group came together in Cooperstown to create the first Hall of Fame class, which was elected by the baseball writers in 1936. It had five members in it. And so two more classes were voted in 37 and 38. As the town of Cooperstown basically put together a building to house what would become the Hall of Fame. And in 1939, the hall was officially opened with its fourth class, but most of the members, the living members of the four classes together came together. And there's a famous picture, which is in the book of 10. Oh, there it is. Oh, okay. There you go. I couldn't see that.
Right. Hanging up in my room in here.
Yeah. And so it's 1939. I mean, every year since the hall has welcomed, you know, baseball, the baseball world to the village. It's expanded dramatically. If you haven't been to the Hall of Fame, you gotta go. It's just a once in a lifetime pilgrimage. Well, hopefully more than once in a lifetime pilgrimage. I think I've been three times. And there's something new to see every time. They have rotating displays. There's new things on display, as well as all some of the stuff that's been there on a regular basis. I just saw a really cool piece in the hall. And the Hall of Fame has some great media, so if you can sign up for their newsletters, they send out stuff almost every day with great stuff about baseball history and on this day in and stories of new members. And I just saw this great piece where Ichiro Suzuki has been to the hall seven times to go into the archives and hold all the stuff, and like everything. And he broke Sisler's record. He went to the hall to hold George Sisler's bat. When he, you know, hit 3,000, he went and talked. That's so cool. Of course, what I love, the tidbit I love is even when he was picking up, he donated the entire outfit when he broke, I forget which particular record, but at one of the records he broke, he just said anything. Sock, shoes, hat, the whole thing. But when he goes back and wants to see it again, he has to wear white gloves to hold his own stuff, which just shows the depth of, you know, care that the hall has. So So that's the Hall. The Hall is started because of the Doubleday myth, and that's why it's in Cooperstown. At this point, the Hall shrugs its shoulders and says, "We get it. You know, we know that, but we're here, and this is where we are, and we want you to come and share this with us."
Yeah, they embrace that now, and yeah. Really, nobody really cares, honestly, at this point. Yeah. I've been one time. It was one of the coolest experiences of my life. My wife and I went. We drove there through upstate New York in this beautiful town, this village that you drive into, and it's picturesque, and it's just unbelievable. I loved it because I had a membership. I could go in and out whenever I wanted to. I didn't have to have a ticket, mm-hmm. so to speak. And what it allowed me to do is this was in the late summer. This was 2 weeks after the induction, 3 weeks after the induction. So all the hubbub had died down.
Right.
It opens in the summer, like at 7 a.m, you know,
wow, that's
closes
awesome.
At 9 p.m. Like it's open a long time. Yeah. And so I would go 8 a.m, whatever time it opened. And I would stay till about 10 or 11. Then all the crazy, you know, it got crazy in the middle of the day. Mm-hmm. But in the evening, there was this fascinating mass exodus. And I was in the, you know, Hall of Plaques, mm-hmm. literally by myself.
That's fantastic.
Basically having the run of the place. And it was this, and during the middle time, I'd go to all the different shops during the day and go buy cards. And
sure, yeah. The whole of Main Street was lined with card memorabilia shops.
Exactly. So it was a wonder. I spent 4 days there, and all my friends were like, "Are you going to spend 4 days looking through a museum?" I didn't see anywhere close to everything.
Oh, yeah.
I was there 4 days.
Yeah.
It was, and my wife, you know, she came a few times. She's certainly she was more interested in sitting on the porch and enjoying
it's a nice thing to do there too. So you got to go and go through
for sure. We went to a winery and went to, you know, all kinds of cool stuff. It's a great place to go visit with your family. And, obviously it's desperately where I want to go back. And if you ask my wife, of all the places we've been that I've dragged her to from a baseball lover standpoint, all the ballparks and all the things we've done, mm-hmm. where would you go back to first? She would say Cooperstown.
And yep, absolutely.
Not even close to second.
Yeah. I do want to mention, if any of you or your viewers are in the Midwest, if you ever have a chance, which I have not yet, and it's very much my bucket list, is to go to the Negro Leagues Museum in Kansas City, which is spectacular. I've seen many, many photos. I love documentaries and videos. So I want to see it in person someday, but especially given the new inclusion of the stats, it's gotten an even bigger rebirth and is a super popular attraction. So if you're in Kansas City, add that to your baseball bucket list. So, Cooperstown's, you don't have to go for the induction. That is kind of a mob scene, and obviously, you know, huge crowds, depending on who gets in, obviously, depends on the size of the crowd. I was there when my hero got inducted, Carly Stramski, back in '89, and along with Johnny Bench. So it's not like I saw a couple of, you know, it wasn't a couple of average major leaguers, Hall of Famers. These were like the, you know, the peak of the peak guys.
Wasn't Cepeda in that class too?
Sorry?
Was Cepeda in that class
too? It was a year later. I think it was just Yaz and Bench that year, but my memory is fogged by Red Soxness, so I couldn't be overstating the case. So it was, and the bookshop there is great. There's books available there, obviously, as well as, you know, all the other usual bookshop places. In this year's edition, we do have some of the history that we just talked about a little bit. I also write a little bit, and I won't give all the secrets away, about the stories of, there's a hotel right on the lake, a beautiful old wooden inn, and it's reserved for the Hall of Fame induction weekend for Hall of Famers and their families. So basically, if you go to the bar there, in every direction, are Hall of Famers telling stories. And we tell some of those stories in the book about what they did there. I think it made it through the edits, but they used to make the incoming rookie Hall of Famers sing a song for the old guys. So, you know, rookie waving, even at the Hall of Fame level, sometimes occurred. There's also a golf tournament that weekend because baseball players love golf. So there's a golf tournament for the players and lots of stuff for fans to do. There's a parade down Main Street of all the members, some exhibition baseball. It's a great weekend.
Another similarity that we share is we grew up team fans. Like, you were a Red Sox fan, I was a Rangers fan. For me, it got bigger than that. It got bigger than one team. And I can't really put my finger on when that evolution happened, or that epiphany probably is a better word for it. Mm-hmm. I was so hungry for anything baseball that, well, the Rangers had such a brief and not so storied history in the 80s. I expanded. I was just hungry to learn more. How did your singular team focus of being a Red Sox fan blossom into loving all of baseball and loving all the stories?
Well, I mean, I've been a fan since the late 60s, so we went through a pretty fallow period ourselves there for a while until 2004. And so I think maybe the same kind of thing is that my team never made it to the World Series, but I still love the World Series. And so that kind of led me to look at the history of the World Series, and that led to discovering some of the great teams of the past and learning about the dynasties. Obviously, our nemesis, the New York Yankees, the greatest team of all time in terms of championships won, they were right there in our face every year, so you sort of couldn't help but, you know, get to know them very well. And then fortunately, professionally, a lot of the work I did at SI was historical. We were in a department that did history sections and look back sections, and I got to write about Bob Gibson and Lou Burdett in 57 and Bob Gibson in 68, and I got to write about Christy Mathewson for one article I did in SI. And so that obviously spurred an even greater knowledge. And I began reading more baseball history, and again, I developed an interest in the very early part of the game. About 20 years ago, I got to be kind of pen pals, email friends with John Thorne, who's the official historian of Major League Baseball. And John and I actually collaborated on a history of baseball for kids that I published with, he wrote and I published in 2011, sadly that didn't sell very well. But that was a great experience to be essentially the feet of a master, to hear the stories of pre-Major League Baseball and before it became, as it grew into a national sport. And that inspired me to read even more about pre-19th century. And if fans there have not read Harold Seymour, I highly recommend a three-part book by Harold Seymour and his wife, whose name just vanished out of my head, but she's a co-writer. Terrific old-time history. There's David Block tells some great stories about baseball before there was even professional baseball in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s. So it's kind of a ripples in a pond. Starts with the Sox are just rippled out, and there's almost no aspect of baseball that I couldn't sit here and talk about for the rest of the day.
Is there a particular story, as you did your research, particularly maybe for this book, because you've done so much history, are you always kind of like discovering, whoa, I never knew that before?
You can't help it. I mean, there's no possible way. Even John Thorne has not heard every baseball story that's ever been told. And there's a constant sort of sense of discovery. As I said, these are very short, compact biographies, but to get to the nuggets, you've got to read, you know, you've got to eat the whole bowl, right? And so I would read multiple long form and in-depth biographies, especially the guys I didn't know a lot about. So writing about Yaz, when I got that done quick. You know, people like Ted Williams and Babe Ruth, people like that. I wrote a biography of Babe Ruth for kids, graphic nonfiction, a comic book, all about Babe Ruth. Show me history, Babe Ruth. Look for it. Great book. Those were easier, but it's the guys you didn't know so much about, but maybe you had to dig a little farther. Okay, what was the nugget for you? What was Ron Santa? Why was Ron's? And I, you know, knew of him certainly, but to read more about what he did and what he meant to the Cubs as a person, as a player, he was more than just the third baseman. He was a real spirit of the team when the team needed a spirit. That's an example. As great as Sandy Koufax was, to read more about him just expanded greatness, if that's possible. Jane Levy's biography of him is the best baseball book I've ever read still. I wrote a book about the history of baseball's perfect games. I think we did enough editions to get through about 20 of them. And then her book on Sandy Koufax came out just about saying that mine did. And I might not as well have even written my book. I should just, that was it. I was so beaten. It was like Pedro Martinez versus a minor little leaguer. It was over. But I highly recommend her book on Sandy Koufax. So that's really it. I can always look for something. You mentioned the Negro League players. Their histories are just still waiting to be told. I read a great book on Josh Gibson because I was starting to write about him. I read a huge, long book about Oscar Charleston and his entire career and life that came out 3 or 4 years ago that just expanded. And because once you get into those stories, they're all become connected. So when you read about Charleston, you read about the history of the Negro Leagues, you learn about Rube Foster, you learn about Satchel Paige, you learn about the Negro League All-Star. The All-Star Game, the 1933 All-Star Game for the Major Leagues, was copying the Negro Leagues. They'd already done one, right? So there were things like that that just, really, you know, in Chicago in 1933. So that sort of stuff just continues to always come up. You almost can't open a great book of baseball history and not find new nuggets.
Yeah. Well, I want to close real quick with just telling you thank you for your hard work on this and
of course, happy
being willing to come on the show. I want to share real quick with everybody. I'm going to share. I have the book pulled up here on the Hall of Fame Baseball Shop. If you're watching on YouTube, I will put a link down below. If you're just listening to the podcast, you can go to the Hall of Fame, you know, baseballhall.org and go to shop and look at books, and you're going to see this book by James Buckley Jr. Talking about celebrating the game's greatest players. And so if you're out there and you're interested, go check it out. If you want to learn more, it's really well done. It's actually, I was surprised at the cost. It's reasonably cost for what it is, honestly. I thought that was very cool. So
not my department, but I'm glad to hear it.
it was good.
Yeah.
And,
I'm glad it's accessible. Definitely, we appreciate it if you buy it at the Hall because, frankly, the Hall gets a bigger cut, and the Hall can obviously always use where it can. It is available, I'm told, on Amazon, although oddly it doesn't come up on a search, but I know it's there. And you can find it. I also, as a longtime author and supporter of independent bookstores, very much suggest if you have an independent bookstore in your neighborhood, visit them and ask them to get the book for you. And they appreciate your support. We need to keep independent bookstores alive and well.
Love it. Well, Jim, thank you so much for your time and everybody out there. I hope you enjoyed this different episode, just talking more about the history of the Hall, something I very near and dear to me that I love, and I love hearing this stuff. So thank you, Jim, again, and everybody out there. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. We'll catch you next week for another episode, and keep collecting.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome.